So it's a pleasure to be here for the Richard Good Lecture. I'd like to talk today about innovation, and I'll define that broadly to include anything that enables more value to be created with fewer resources.
In this program, Nobel laureate Michael Kremer on how innovation is not only an important driver of economic growth, but can save lives and the planet.
Historically, innovation has also enabled tremendous advances in human health, and I'll argue that technological change may be key to environmental sustainability.
Michael Kremer is professor of economics at the University of Chicago, where he founded the Development Innovation Lab, and his groundbreaking work on poverty reduction with colleagues Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee won him the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2019. Kremer was invited in December to deliver the IMF's annual Richard Good Lecture. This podcast is an abridged version of his presentation. You can watch a webcast of the entire event at imf.org.
So in today's talk, what I'd like to do is first discuss some cases, drawing on economic theory, in which commercial incentives for innovation are much less than social needs. And that's going to result in underinvestment, in particularly in some types of innovation, and potentially create a role for public investment. I'll then move to apply that framework to think about innovation to address some global challenges. And I'll give some examples where the social value of research likely greatly exceeds the commercial value based on the principles discussed in the first part of the talk. Then the last part of the talk, I'll discuss how governments and multilateral bodies can help create new institutions to accelerate innovation and to shape it to address some of these challenges, while also maintaining control over costs and reducing the risk of government failures that can lead to throwing good money after bad in the pursuit of innovation. So successful innovation systems often include both upfront or what's sometimes called push funding, for example, the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation in the United States, but also the pull of rewards for successful innovations. A pharmaceutical firm that develops certain types of new drug will earn billions of dollars from those. But for some of the examples, some of the social crises that we're facing, these incentives are currently too weak. And I'll discuss two institutional innovations that I've been involved with, one on the push side and one on the pull side, that are designed to address this. One is tiered evidence-based social innovation funds, and the other is advanced market commitments. So let me turn to some of the cases in which economic theory suggests that commercial incentives for innovation may be much less than the social value of innovation. So the first case, I think, is fairly straightforward, which is when there are externalities. So existing institutions like patents might create incentives for innovation that are roughly commensurate with social value of innovation in some cases. And in some special cases, they can actually create excessive incentives for innovation. But in the cases I'll focus on, and I think they're more common, the cases in which the commercial incentives will be too weak. So coming to the case of externalities, if innovations create benefits not just for the user of the good, or even primarily for the user of the good, then commercial incentives to create the innovation might be very weak. So a good example of this would be innovations that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, for example, in cement production. If we could find a way of inventing cement production methods that don't require as much emissions, that would provide huge benefits to the world, but there's no reason why the customers would necessarily pay more, and hence there's limited incentives to invest in developing that technology. A second category is where there are very low barriers to entry for firms that follow the innovator. So, there are many cases in which inventions or innovations are not really patentable, and are not easy to protect with first mover advantages. And it's very easy for subsequent competitors to enter the market and compete away profits. And that obviously reduces commercial incentives to be the innovator, but it actually increases the social value of the innovation because as new firms enter and compete, that reduces prices and broadens access. So when barriers to entry are limited, there may be much less incentive to develop those innovations. A particular subcase that I think is very important is scientific advances which enable other innovations. So, you know, if you think about the development of calculus, for example, obviously that was vital to developing many other innovations. But you can't patent calculus. And similarly, it's hard to make money from ideas such as evolution or quantum mechanics. And so the commercial incentives for developing those scientific innovations won't match their social value. And we needed other institutions to encourage this. For example, universities and support for university research. But, you know, this doesn't just apply to basic science. Other innovations share this property. So, for example, developing good biomarkers for use in developing further medical technology or sensors to pick up environmental changes can in turn help the development of other pharmaceutical or environmental technologies, but they're probably not rewarded appropriately. A third case is where there's a monopsony buyer. A specific subcase is innovations in government services, such as improvements in tax administration, digital tools to support teachers or health workers or agricultural extension workers in delivering services. You know, once those innovations are developed, the government's going to be the primary purchaser. They have a lot of market power. They can use that to hold prices down or just to themselves imitate the innovation. And, you know, that means the commercial returns from developing innovations such as these will not match the social value. Another category is innovations which will be subject to price controls or other ethical or social limits on pricing. And a subcase of that is innovations to address crises. For example, R&D for pandemic preparedness. You know, there's going to be, you know, for better or for worse, there's going to be social and political limits on pricing of essential drugs during pandemics. And that again means that there's the social value of investing in these development of these drugs is much greater than the commercial value. And hence, there's at least a potential case for public support for investing in these innovations. So if we think about the case of the COVID pandemic, and thinking mostly forward about pandemic preparedness in the future, but taking COVID as an example, you know, the costs have been estimated at $14 trillion. You know, based on IMF estimates, we calculated early in the pandemic that advancing the development and distribution of vaccines by a single month would be worth $500 billion. That implies that the social value of an extra course of vaccine capacity was almost $6,000 at that point, in terms of both the lives saved and the economic costs of the pandemic averted. But the price per course of the most expensive vaccines was about $40. Now, you know, the limits on pricing during a pandemic may be perfectly justifiable. I'm not arguing about whether there should be limits on pricing. But given that there will be these limits on pricing, there's going to be a market failure there. And we need other ways of supporting this vital investment. Now, some governments, like that of the US or the UK, made large public investments in R&D and capacity development very early in the pandemic in exchange for getting the option to purchase a vaccine. In ordinary circumstances, I'm not necessarily a big fan of governments paying to build factories before an invention is demonstrated to work. They did this early before we knew whether the vaccines would work. But in the case of the COVID pandemic, that was the right call because of the inadequate market incentives. So turning to look forward, Glenister et al. Estimate the probability of a pandemic half as intense as COVID-19 or worse at 2.6% per year. So it's probably not going to happen in the next few years, but it probably will happen in the next, you know, 50 years. And that implies that the expected annual cost from pandemics is $800 billion every year. So shocks of that, if we actually get another one of these shocks, they have huge macroeconomic consequences. COVID-19 led to, in 2020, global government debt increased by 13 percentage points of GDP. And, these types of crises threaten financial stability and debt crises and default. And they also threaten political instability. They're also a threat to the global trading system. And we saw bans on exports of vaccines and inputs for vaccines and hoarding. Today, we're seeing bans on food exports in response to price shocks. So even a small chance of avoiding these immense costs and these systemic risks justifies a fair amount of expenditure on investment. My collaborator, Alex Tabarrok, called this the world's easiest cost-benefit calculation. Investing in scientific R&D, for example, in developing a universal vaccine against coronaviruses or other approaches like improved ventilation and filtration systems that can prevent aerosol transmission or UV lighting that can kill germs, and social innovations such as new ways of increasing vaccine take-up, that could take billions of dollars. We normally think carefully before spending billions of dollars, and that's appropriate. But it's far less than the trillions of dollars another pandemic would cost. So, his slogan was billions or less than trillions. And I think that's the lesson to take away. So I think that creates a potential role for public investment. Let me turn to the case of climate change. As with pandemics, the estimated cost of climate change is the numbers are hard to comprehend. One estimate suggests that a scenario with 2 degrees of warming would cost $61 trillion. And the tail risks are many, many times higher than that. So I think we need to invest both in innovations for mitigation and innovations for adaptation. And we've seen the potential of innovation, just as we have with vaccines, in the case of climate. The price of solar energy has fallen by around 90% between 2009 and 2019. The price of lithium-ion battery storage declined by 97% since 1990. But we also need investments in other mitigation technologies, ranging from advanced geothermal energy to improve manufacturing processes for steel, to direct air capture, to feed additives that could substantially reduce methane emissions from livestock. Not all of these are going to work, but it's worth taking some risks and an investment. And in fact, we should think of them as providing insurance rather than as risks. We also need social innovations, like better designed payments for ecosystem services. Recent studies suggest paying farmers to take actions to protect ecosystems, whether it's maintaining trees and planting and maintaining trees or reducing stubble burning, can benefit the environment, increase incomes, and improve food security, and may be a very, very cost-effective means, if designed properly, of addressing global warming. Beyond mitigation, we also need innovations for adaptation. That would include better weather forecast systems, so farmers can understand what's coming and plan for it, weather responsive cash transfers, digital agricultural extension, as farmers will need to adjust their techniques. Again, there's limited incentives to invest in these under current institutions. I've focused on market failures so far, but we also need to recognize the importance of government failures. There are lots of examples of success through government investment in innovation, like Operation Warp Speed, but there are also plenty of examples of failure, and worse than failure, governments continuing to invest in technologies that don't look like they're going anywhere, long past the point where they should be shifting to other areas. Just bureaucratic momentum to do that. So while innovation is inherently risky, there are important issues of how we can reduce the political risk of wasteful investment, and both to conserve resources, but also to make sure the resources are going to in the right areas. So we've had a number of what I'll call meta-innovations, innovations in systems for encouraging innovation that have had tremendous positive impacts. And I don't want to claim these are perfect. You're always dealing in a second best world here. So there's some negative side effects as well. But for example, you know, I think those of us in the academic world take the peer review system for granted sometimes. But you know, this is not that old. It was developed around World War II by Vannevar Bush in the United States, at least. And we can debate it, and there's all sorts of problems with peer review systems, but they're probably better than the systems that we had before. Another example is the development of experimental approaches. So in medicine, those provide evidence as to whether new drugs or vaccines are effective. And again, the FDA in the U.S. is constantly refining its methods for using those randomized trials, but the basic system is a very useful one. So Esther Duflo, Abhijit Banerjee and I, along with many others, have worked to extend that approach from medicine to economics and other areas of social science research. And I think that's something that actually offers a lot of potential for social innovations, as I'll discuss later. But in part because of these types of social, of institutional innovations, public R&D investments have had very high returns. One study found that public R&D investments in the U.S. had an annual social rate of return of 55%. So let me discuss two particular approaches to creating new institutions for innovation that I've been involved with that are both designed to discipline efforts to invest in innovation to avoid unnecessary risk of waste. Some is, you know, innovation is risky, investment is risky. So let me discuss first one that is designed to encourage investment in social innovations. I focused a lot on technological innovations, but social innovations can also be very important. But discipline that effort by accompanying social innovation with rigorous testing, typically using RCTs. So, you know, there are multiple examples of this. Chile's Office of Experimental Policy identifies and rigorously tests ideas developed by units within the Chilean government. Behavioral insight units, which are started in the UK but have now been adopted in many countries, look for opportunities to apply insights from behavioral economics to improve the functioning of government. But focusing on open, tiered, evidence-based social innovation funds. So one example of this is Development Innovation Ventures in the United States, which I helped set up and where I, you know, serve as scientific director, so I should disclose that. Another recently established example is France's Fund for Innovation and Development, led by Esther Duflo. Okay, now, there's lots of evidence, which I cited earlier, on high returns to scientific R&D. But there's less evidence on the returns to social science RCTs or social entrepreneurship and impact investing. There are plenty of anecdotes of success, but there are also plenty of anecdotes of failure. DIV was founded about a bit over 10 years ago. So we took a look at the portfolio from our early investments to see it takes time for innovations to come to fruition. But we thought it was worth taking a look and seeing what the impact is. You know, and some innovations take many decades. So there's tiered funding. There's applications for pilot funding. Initially that was, you know, under $100,000. I guess a number so small it doesn't deserve mention in this room. There's funding for rigorous testing. And again, when we started out, that was up to $1 million. And then for the most, the rigorous testing is typically, but not always, with randomized controlled trials. And part of the idea of this design is that small amounts of money can be available to take on some risky investments. But then before larger amounts of money are committed, there has to be evidence of impact and cost effectiveness. So for the larger funding is for transitioning to scale is only available after that test has been met. So this chart shows the first 43 awards that we made over our first 2.5 years. And it shows the number of people reached. So in, you know, most of the people that were reached by DIV were reached by a very small number of innovations. 9 out of the 41 innovations reached over a million people, and they account for 98% of the people reached. So this is a reason why going by anecdotes can be very misleading. If you can pick examples of tremendous success, but also many examples of either outright failure or modest benefits. I'll discuss a little bit later what the social return on this is, or lower bound on that. But let me note that for 5 of these innovations, 5 of the 41 and 5 of the 9 that reached over a million people, we were able to get estimates of the value of the benefits. Because there was a randomized trial, we knew how many people the innovation reached, and the innovation was something where you could potentially quantify the benefits, either in health using standard health methodologies for that, or just straight economic returns. But let me say first, which innovations scale. So, there's a common view in development that pilots never scale. And indeed, it would be logical to expect that a much higher scaling rate among the later stage innovations, and that's what we see. But if you look at the data a slightly different way, and you ask how many people were reached per dollar spent, you get a very different picture. Actually, for pilot and innovations, and for innovations where we supported testing, they actually did extremely well in terms of the number of people reached per dollar spent. Now, look, I don't want to claim statistical significance out of this very small sample, but I think this suggests that it is indeed worth taking some risky bets, as long as you're able to put in controls to stop additional money being sunk into these if they don't work out. Here's another, I think, very interesting chart. So, this is part of USAID. It's oriented towards innovations for low and middle income countries. And a key predictor is the cost of the innovation. It was very inexpensive innovations had a much higher scaling rate. Along with that, and I think this is something that you see in the venture capital industry as well, a lot of entrepreneurs think that, well, we're gonna develop something and sell it directly to customers. But, a lot of successful businesses sell either to other businesses or to governments. And we saw if products have to be under $3, the customer acquisition costs are going to be a real barrier with direct to consumer sales. So there was a much higher scaling rate among innovations designed to be sold to businesses and governments. And then finally, there's often a view that doing a lot of testing and formal testing is expensive, it takes time, people want results quickly. And bringing in researchers to be involved in formal randomized trials is going sort of the enemy of rapid innovation and flexible innovation. We actually saw, when we looked at our data, that these are correlations and not causal evidence, but there was actually a much higher rate of scaling among innovations which involved RCTs or involved development economics researchers. Now, those two things are very collinear, so it's not possible to separate out the effects. But there could be multiple reasons for that. Maybe innovators who really believe in their ideas are more willing to have them tested. But I think that one possible reason, in many fields of inquiry, it's very common for researchers to then get involved in innovation. Nobody thinks it's odd that graduate students in computer science would go on to form a firm in the ICT world, or that researchers in biochemistry might go found a biotech company. I think economists have typically seen their role as just analyzing data or doing theory, not as developing innovations. And I think those are very important roles for economics. I don't get me wrong. But I think there's now some areas within economics, both economic theory, where people are involved in problems like auction design or matching problems, and development economics, where economists have engaged on concrete problems and turned their skills to develop and scale innovations, or develop the innovations and test them and maybe help facilitate the scaling rather than understand them abstractly. So I think this is some evidence, very imperfect, that we may be, that approach may be successful as well. Okay, so I've talked about the rate of scaling, but what we really care about is, is this a good investment? So let me show you some data. And if you think back to that earlier graph, we supported 41 innovations. We were able to quantify benefits for 5 of them. So for those, if we set those benefits against the cost, here's what we find. And we tried to use very conservative approaches in multiple ways. The total cost of our portfolio during this period was $16 million. The benefit-cost ratio we found, and this is we're just taking the data up through 2019, was 17-1. Now, that raises a puzzle for economists. Why these positive social returns when, a government funder is subject to all sorts of bureaucracy and inevitably, and doesn't that, how can that happen? Well, I think the hypothesis, if you think back to the first part of the talk, there are some areas where commercial incentives are weak and commercial investors leave arbitrage opportunities for socially motivated investors, and those are areas where there's low ex-ante expected private returns. So, the cases I discussed before, low barriers to entry, if the potential customer for the innovation is the government, if the customer doesn't obtain the full value of the product. And, many of the cases that were successful fall into that area. So you can think about, different types of innovation. Some would have high private return and very high social value, cell phones, for example. Those might be areas the private sector is going to pursue on its own. And it's not clear that it really makes sense for the government to go after those areas. There are areas that are socially bad and maybe commercially profitable, cigarettes, maybe government wants to stay out of those areas. There's obviously a huge area in the bottom left quadrant of ideas that social entrepreneurs that are fads that people will sell that are not privately profitable or socially valuable. But I think there's some innovations that could be commercially sustainable if they succeed, but they're not sufficiently profitable that it's worth the ex-ante investment. That's one area where governments can invest and or support investment. And the other is there are a bunch of innovations that may not be commercially sustainable ever, like technologies to reduce election fraud that governments are going to have to implement. But those things also warrant government investment. There are also implications for the design of social innovation funds. And there's often a feeling that we should try to imitate venture capital. And I think there are a lot of analogies with venture capital and cases for governments to pursue those methods. But I think there are also some important differences. And there are design features that may generate social value in excess of private value. So these types of institutions, open tiered social innovation funds, they've been used by the US, by France, there's related things in Chile and Tamil Nadu, but I think there's a lot of scope for governments to set these up to address the problems they're facing, or for, in the case of, whether it's environment problems or pandemics, for governments and philanthropists to establish things focused on those challenges. But those can provide upfront funding, but it's also very useful to have the pull of a reward for successful technology. And the traditional approach to this is intellectual property systems to reward innovations with monopoly rights. So if you develop an innovation, you get a temporary monopoly. But of course, the cost of that is it limits access. And that's obviously generated considerable controversy. There's constant debates and tinkering with patent laws and intellectual property rights. And that inherently involves a trade-off between dynamic incentives for dynamic considerations. We want to encourage innovation. But on the other hand, there's static losses from monopoly. And that sounds very bloodless. But if you think about a new HIV drug, high prices, the cost of that may be very high for the world. So one approach that I've been involved in developing is advanced market commitments. And those have the potential to simultaneously incentivize R&D and improve access. And in fact, you can structure them to substantially boost R&D incentives in cases where the commercial incentives seem much less than the social value. So, you know, Rachel Glenister and I first proposed advanced market commitments in the early 2000s as a way to incentivize R&D for vaccines against diseases like malaria that were concentrated in low and middle income countries. But let me give an example of where this was actually implemented, which was an advanced market commitment against pneumococcus, a disease that killed millions of people, for which there were vaccines against the strains common in high-income countries, but not in low- and middle-income countries. A group of donors came together and made a $1.5 billion commitment, and again, just over 10 years ago, that if a vaccine were developed that was effective against those strains, and if countries were willing to buy it, they would top up the price by $3.50 per dose in exchange for a commitment by the companies to limit pricing in the long run and to hold down pricing. This is voluntary for the companies, so their incentives can only be increased by this. And the idea is this replaces a small quantity of sales at a relatively high price with a large quantity of sales at a lower price, but in a way that can increase revenue. And it thus addresses access as well, because a large number of doses are purchased. So in this particular case, what happened was three firms developed vaccines against the strains common in developing countries. They've now reached hundreds of millions of people and saved an estimated 700,000 lives. So I think, you know, with any of these innovations, there's going to be, you're not going to get it right the first time or probably ever. There'll be constant, you know, there's a need for improvements in the design. But I think this shows that these types of advanced market commitments have the potential to both to accelerate innovation and to expand access. And this approach, because the risk falls on the product developer, the government's only going to buy this product if it meets these technical criteria, then that limits some of the political risk of governments just invested in something that actually has no technological hope of going forward. And I think this approach can be used not just for pharmaceuticals and vaccines, but can be applied to other challenges like climate change. And in fact, there are some ongoing efforts to arrange advanced market commitments for direct air capture. So to summarize, innovation has, you know, very high rates of return. It can be about much more than supporting economic growth. You know, it can address a range of human health and environmental needs. But for innovation to support those needs, we need appropriate social institutions to incentivize the innovation and ensure it reaches the people who need it. You know, there are a lot of great things about our existing system of government support for innovation and intellectual property rights to encourage the private sector, but they leave some very important gaps. And I've offered two types of institutions that, you know, we now have some practical experience with and that seem to deliver very high returns, or at least have the potential for that. So I think there's a strong case for both more investment in innovations to address some global challenges, more public investment, but also for further exploration of meta-innovations to improve our innovation systems to address these challenges and many others. Thank you.
That was Michael Kremer delivering the 2022 Richard Good Lecture. You'll find a webcast of the entire event at imf.org. Kremer is professor of economics at the University of Chicago and director of the Development Innovation Lab. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2019 for his work on experimental approaches to alleviating global poverty. There are hundreds of other IMF podcasts featuring some of the most influential economists out there. Check them out wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.